Just be seated and be silent, or you leave the room. Peter Becker, just sit down, dear friends. Okay, so this is a crucial moment we have reached now in the course of the conference. That is the item returning to the ICJ again or not, also reflecting on results of previous sessions. And I would like immediately give the floor to Alan from LCNP, from Yalana, other organizations. I think there's no need for introducing him to this conference, and he will give his introduction to the following discussion. Alan, you have the floor, please.
Thank you, Manfred. Thanks, Manfred. Because we're running a little bit late, I'll try and shorten my presentation. And for those who want the more detailed version, it's drawn from... My presentation is drawn from a paper which that I've written on taking the bomb back to court, which is a working paper examining the question of returning to the International Court of Justice on the legality of the threat or use of nuclear weapons following up on the 1996 advisory opinion and the obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. If there's not enough copies of the paper, we do have it available on the website, disarmsecure.org. This has come out of 2 years of research and consultations that we've been organising from the Eolana Pacific office down in New Zealand, but consulting with many of you and also consultations with other disarmament experts, and we've begun the process of consultations with governments on these issues. Peter Weiss, John Burrows, Jackie Gabasso and myself have been doing quite a lot of the consultations, and some people have also been consulting with their own governments on this. The key, so I'm going to do a bit of an overview, the key things that I'll just be reflecting briefly on, why return to the International Court of Justice for a follow-up opinion, what type of case, whether contentious or advisory, what questions are people considering be included in the return to the court, what outcome might we expect looking at the composition of the current composition of the court, and what progress has been made to get to the court so far, and what are some of the political questions with regards to return to the court. I'd like to start by just acknowledging the work that Von van den Biesen and Eolana Netherlands has done on the idea of returning to the court, and the very excellent research that was done. That was focused very much on the idea of a contentious case. There has been a shift, I guess, in emphasis in the consultations to the advisory opinion approach. I'll mention that briefly later on, but I just want to mention that because the work that we've been doing has based, you know, firstly on that, and then from other work, we've had a couple of good interns have been working in our office down in New Zealand on this for a couple of years, and also the excellent work from the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy on the disarmament obligation, which John and Jackie have already talked a little bit about. Why return to the court? There's probably a couple of things to look at in considering this question. One is the consideration of the issue of the non-implementation by the nuclear weapon states of their disarmament obligations, and whether a return to the court can provide any additional legal and political weight on such implementation. Another question is whether there is any difference of opinion on legal responsibilities. And the third one to look at is what sort of influence might a decision have? Firstly, with regards to the implementation of the obligations arising from or affirmed by the 1996 opinion. There were, I guess, two main sort of obligations that were looked at in the 1996 opinion. One was, of course, the disarmament obligation, and that was the one that was part of the unanimous conclusion of the court. The other one, and that, I guess we'd call that a positive obligation, an obligation to conduct a particular activity, and that is negotiations, to conclude negotiations on nuclear disarmament in all its aspects. The other obligations, we'd say, would be more the negative obligations. Those are obligations of what states are required not to do, and this is in the determination of the court or the affirmation of the court of the general illegality of the threat or use of nuclear weapons. Now, the nuclear weapon states have done very little on these. They have not reduced the roles of nuclear weapons in their security doctrines in order to reflect the general illegality of the threat or use of nuclear weapons as affirmed by the court. In contrast, they are expanding the roles for nuclear weapons and the situations in what they might be threatened or used. With regards to the disarmament obligation, the nuclear weapon states have not made much progress on that. And in fact, they continue to oppose or block negotiations in the Conference on Disarmament, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty review conferences, and they're trying to also block progress in the United Nations General Assembly. There was some small responses, one could say, to the decision of the court, if one can claim that these developments were actually as a result of the court. But following the decision in 96, the United Kingdom did lower the operational status of their nuclear forces, reduced their nuclear forces to one system, and undertook a study on nuclear verification to support a nuclear disarmament process. Russia also modified its nuclear doctrine to affirm that they would only use nuclear weapons in the extreme circumstance when the very survival of the state was at stake. However, these were very minimal changes, and there's been very little that's been done since then. So would the a case from the court, a decision, have any influence on the nuclear weapon states? Fonn sort of talked early on with regards to the difference, I guess, between a contentious case and advisory opinion, and that really that with an advisory opinion is not binding on the states. However, what we saw from the 1996 decision is that while there might not have been immediate direct moves from the nuclear weapon states, except for the minimal ones that I mentioned, there was quite an impact on the international disarmament agenda from the 1996 opinion. We had a non-nuclear weapon states used the opinion to support their calls for nuclear disarmament proposals. So the New Agenda Coalition, for example, a group of seven countries, which was very influential in the 2000 NBT Review Conference, stressed very much the responsibilities arising or affirmed from the 1996 advisory opinion. A number of other states used the opinion as well. Malaysia drafted a follow-up resolution to the 1996 decision, calling on implementation of the disarmament obligation through negotiations that would lead to the conclusion of a nuclear weapons convention. Costa Rica followed this up with submitting to the United Nations a model nuclear weapons convention, which had been drafted by a consortium of lawyers, disarmed experts, and that, in a sense, raised the profile of the nuclear weapons convention and the possibility for the abolition of nuclear weapons. Also, civil society groups like Abolition 2000 and its constituent members used the 1996 opinion to help support in civil society the idea of the nuclear disarmament and the abolition of nuclear weapons. So even if there might not be an immediate direct impact on the policies and practices of the nuclear weapon states, an advisory opinion can help develop political momentum and political support for nuclear disarmament, which can have some impact. So in that case, there does seem to be, you know, a rationale for returning to the court, particularly at this particular time when the policies of the nuclear weapon states are going backwards rather than forwards. And also, given that it's the 10th anniversary, it's a political opportunity, in a sense, to highlight that decision from the court. So what type of case would be useful to take to the court? Fon talked a little bit about the advantages of a contentious case and the disadvantages of an advisory opinion. So I won't go through those aspects. I'll just mention some of the advantages of an advisory opinion so that we've got sort of, you know, those ideas sort of out there to help us in moving forward on this. The advantage of an advisory opinion approach is that it would follow up the approach taken by the United Nations General Assembly, and that the United Nations General Assembly requested the opinion back in 94. It's followed up on it every year with a resolution calling for its implementation. So it's quite appropriate for the United Nations General Assembly to return to the court in order to help give guidance to the implementation that it's already attempting to achieve. Another advantage for an advisory opinion is that the decision of the ICJ would not be confined to specific states, which might be the subject to a contentious case. It would be a matter, a question on international law, which would be universally applicable. In addition, it would be a much simpler case, an advisory opinion, than a contentious case. In a contentious case, you'd have to work out who would be the defendants, who would be the plaintiffs. And with each of the defendants, there would be a slightly different case because their nuclear policies and practices and capacities are different. So a contentious case would actually be quite a multiplicity case, which would be quite tricky. Whereas the advisory opinion, you'd just specify which particular questions on the disarmament obligations or the policies and practices you'd want to consider. Finally, it would be a little bit, it'd be politically easier to do an advisory opinion approach because you wouldn't have the same political pressure that we put against the few states that might be taking a contentious case. Instead, you'd have a group of like-minded countries that would be working together, and so it would give them a lot more political strength. And in fact, in our consultations with the governments, we have found very little support for going for a contentious case because of the political difficulties that individual states would have taking a contentious case. We have found a lot of interest in the advisory opinion approach, enough interest to give us confidence that it's worthwhile to move ahead. There isn't a country that has come out yet saying they would sponsor a General Assembly resolution this year, but there are a number of countries that said if there is something moving ahead, they would most likely be part of that. So for that purpose, in the paper that I did, I concentrated a little bit more on the advisory opinion approach, and in the consultations which we've been having in Geneva and in New York primarily, we've been concentrating a little bit more on that also. Now, what about the questions to ask of the court? And this is very difficult. There's a range of types of questions which could be asked relating to nuclear weapons policies and practices. I'd say there's three general categories. First one would be to follow up on the disarmament obligation, to ask whether states are in compliance with the obligation to bring to a conclusion disarmament, nuclear disarmament obligations. And if they're not, what would be required of them? What would be the elements of good faith? And this is something John talked about earlier. Another question would be to look at the current nuclear policies and practices. And so, for example, there's a range of those that could be considered by the court. The threat or use of nuclear weapons against a non-nuclear weapon state. The threat or use of nuclear weapons first in any conflict. deploying nuclear weapons during peacetime on high operational readiness or under launch on warning operational policy. The threat or use of nuclear weapons as weapons of mass retaliation, including counter-value targeting, that's targeting against cities or non-military targets. The threat or use of specific nuclear weapons, such as high-yield weapons or strategic weapons, that regardless of the provocation, their destructive capacity would render them incapable of conforming to the principles and rules of international humanitarian law. The threat or use of nuclear weapons preemptively in response to the development or the suspected development of chemical, biological or nuclear weapons, the testing of nuclear weapons, and the establishment or the maintenance of plans or agreements to transfer control over nuclear weapons to non-nuclear weapon states, that is the nuclear sharing arrangements in NATO. These are all issues which have been suggested by different states, by lawyers, by other disarmament experts in the consultation process. There are pluses and minuses for asking questions on each of these. There's pluses and minuses of asking a question on that category, on the policies and practices of nuclear weapons. There are some people of the opinion that we should keep a question to the court simple, that it should just be on the disarmament obligation. There are others who think that if you don't ask the question on the nuclear policies and practices, then it will keep the threat of nuclear weapons very, very real, that if we continue with the doctrines as they are, then the possibility of a nuclear use by miscalculation, by accident, or by purposeful use will remain high until you get to the end process of the negotiations, which could take a long, long time. In addition, if we're not addressing the policies and practices of the nuclear weapon states, they'll resist the nuclear disarmament negotiations. So there's some feeling that there really does need to be attention to both the disarmament obligation and the nuclear policies and practices. And finally, on the preventive use of force, that's something which is very topical at the moment. We've seen an example of that with the preventive use of force against Iraq and the chaos that is created. There is the possibility of preventive use of force in other circumstances. Iran is one possibility. And there is incredible political attention on this issue, and perhaps that would be a useful question to ask the court. On the other hand, it is building in law that goes a bit beyond what the court was considering in 1996, and some have suggested that perhaps that should be the subject of a different question instead. So that's some of the considerations on those questions. What sort of outcome might we expect? Well, it's very hard to sort of predetermine what's going to come from a court. There are a couple of things that you sort of base some idea of what sort of outcome you get. One is on the strength of the legal arguments. Another is on the composition of the court. In 1994, when we went to the court, by the time we got to the court, we actually had not a very helpful composition. We had a couple of very good judges, including Judge Weeramantry, but the composition of the court was 8 out of the 14 judges were from nuclear weapon states or their strong allies. So it was a very tough case. The composition of the court today and looking into the near future looks a lot more positive. We have 7 of the 15 judges are from the nuclear weapon states or their strong allies, so we have more of a majority on the other side. In addition to this, and we must remember that the judges don't represent the countries, so there is some degree of independence that they have with regards to what type of decisions they will give and their perspectives on the court. But in practice, a lot of the judges do come up through the political and legal systems of their countries, and so they often do reflect to some degree some of their country's perspectives. But in this particular case, it's interesting because the judges from the nuclear weapon states, there does seem to be some indication that there might be some more flexibility or with regards to their perspectives on these issues. For example, Thomas Bergenthal, the United States judge, has spoken publicly very critical of US military policy. For example, he spoke at a commencement address to the George Washington Law School in 2004, saying that, and I quote, "Unbecoming of our democratic tradition, We seem to have become, he's talking about the United States policy, we seem to have become intoxicated with our military might, forgetting that even superpowers need friends. It is not enough to preach democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. We must be seen to practice what we preach, not only at home, but also abroad. Also, if we have a look at the Russian judge, Leonid Skotnikov, he has written condemning the preventive use of force in international affairs, and he's also written on the primacy of law in international relations, including the imperative of basing state actions on and international relations on, I quote, the force of law rather than the law of force. So we see some interesting developments with the composition. I won't go more into it. We have a couple of very good judges on the court, but we don't have time to go through all of that. But and of course, their previous writings and previous decisions don't mean that's exactly how they're going to decide in whatever case might come up, but it gives some sort of bearing on where things might go. But generally, there seems to be quite a positive court there at the moment. Okay, and I'll conclude with just the political process of getting to the court. I mentioned that we've had a number of consultations with governments. Now, these we can't sort of like publicly talk about what countries are positive at the moment, because if we came out with that, the pressure on those individual countries would be intense. In fact, just to give an example of that, when we were lobbying for the case at the General Assembly in 1993, and the non-aligned movement first submitted the General Assembly resolution, and then there was incredible political pressure on Indonesia by the United States. There were a lot of deals that were happening at the moment, including an F-16 deal, and the US had some influence on Indonesia. Indonesia withdrew the General Assembly resolution. We had a group of states that was ready to introduce the resolution that year. It was a group of about 10 states. The nuclear weapon states found out which of those states they were. One by one, they picked them off, and within 5 days, all of them came back and said, sorry, we've had too much pressure from the nuclear weapon states. We can't do it now. The same sort of thing would happen if we came too soon with saying which of the states are interested in this, which is why we can't publicly say it, but we can say there is general interest. But they do have to build up a support. But one indication is at the OPNAL meeting. That's the Organization for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons in Latin America. This is the states' parties to the Latin American and Caribbean Nuclear Weapon Free Zone. Their meeting in November, they adopted the Santiago Declaration, which included a paragraph calling on the United Nations to take action at this General Assembly, reflecting the 10th anniversary of the ICJ opinion, to look at how that decision could be implemented. The subtext from that was they want to see a return to the International Court of Justice, but they couldn't say it straight away. With regards to whether a General Assembly resolution could be adopted this year, I doubt it. It's going to take some time to build up the like-minded group that will be required. In addition, a key focus this year at the General Assembly could be the return of the question of the subcommittees of the General Assembly that was proposed last year, the subcommittees that would start deliberations and negotiations on nuclear disarmament items. Now, delegations, if they're looking at these two particular issues, these would be the two biggest issues to try to move things forward. If they're looking at those two, they can really only spend their political capital on one, and they will probably go for the idea of setting up the subcommittees first this year and then swinging in with the legal and political impetus from a World Court opinion following that to support the process of the subcommittees of the General Assembly. So that's probably the way that that would happen. So I'll conclude there, and thanks a lot for the opportunity to present some of these ideas.
Did you just listen to the speech delivered by Alan Ware from the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy?